Centre at 6. The Welsh NHS is suspending all non-urgent operations because of the coronavirus outbreak. It's also speeding up the discharging of vulnerable patients. There's been a 35% jump in confirmed COVID-19 cases across the UK. Almost 800 people have tested positive, while Scotland's announced its first death. The patient was elderly and had other health problems. Labour's Shadow Health Secretary Jonathan Ashworth says the public's clearly concerned.
I would urge the government, who are saying that they're basing all their decisions on science, to be clearer about the assumptions they are taking about human behaviour and to publish the science, publish the modelling, so the experts can stress test it, so they can peer review it.
The head of the World Health Organization says Europe is now the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. The worst affected country on the continent, Italy, has seen 250 more deaths in the past day. And in Spain, the number of confirmed infections has jumped to more than 4,000. The country's declaring a state of emergency from tomorrow, and the Foreign Office is advising against non-essential travel to several Spanish regions, including Madrid. Paul Hodkinson, who lives there, says he'll be staying in this weekend.
Nothing's open, so there's nowhere to actually go to socialise. The bars have literally been closed, restaurants closed, so it's just a case of follow the advice and, take it easy.
This evening, the Eiffel Tower in Paris will close until further notice. The London Marathon has been moved back from April to October due to the outbreak. Meanwhile, all professional football in England, Scotland and Wales has been suspended until at least the 3rd of April. Tomorrow's Rugby Union Six Nations clash between Wales and Scotland in Cardiff is also now off, and one of golf's biggest events, the Masters, has been postponed. One major sporting event that did go ahead today was the Cheltenham Festival. Last year's winner, Album Photo, retains the gold Cup, holding off a challenge from Santini. That's the latest. I'm Kip Bradshaw.
Blues Party will be taking place at the Malcolm X Community Centre.
We've done what can be done to contain this disease, and this is for us. But now a global pandemic, the number of cases.
This is the Friday Politics Show, and my name's Roma Widger, and I'm standing in for Tony Gosling and Martin Summers, our old friend Martin, who's here quite a lot. We are doing the politics show today, and it's sad that Mark Wright from Hotwells can't come in. He was the guest, but get well soon, Mark. And Martin and I will be talking about what's going on in the world, probably, as well as, and in the instance of the virus. The virus, there's nothing else apparently going on. It's just the virus, the virus, the virus. Well, Martin, I would say to you, is there anything else going on, or is in fact, is this a convenient mishap?
There's a lot going on apart from the virus. The Russians and the Saudis refused to, or they couldn't agree about what the oil price should be. So there's been an oil price crash, which people in the markets are well aware that the coronavirus plus the oil price crash is what's forcing the markets down. And there's a standoff in Syria between the Turks and the Russians, which both sides have lost casualties on, which in other circumstances would be, this is a trigger for World War III. And, of course, there's all sorts of stuff going out there on the internet about where this virus has come from. What were the Chinese, one of the Chinese spokespeople today, because was... when Trump said it's the Chinese virus, they've responded by saying, well, we suspect that this is an American biological warfare agent. The Chinese have said that today. And, of course, that's one of the suspicions about this virus, that it's not just a random virus, that it's a biological warfare agent, possibly from Wuhan, possibly from somewhere else. But I don't think it makes much sense for us to speculate too much about that, because we don't know. But all of these things are linked. The virus is like the cherry on the cake of things that have been brewing for a long time.
Well, let's hear what the government's position is. We've got Boris here. Here he is.
We've done what can be done to contain this disease, and this has brought us valuable time. But it's now a global pandemic, and the number of cases will rise sharply. Indeed, the true number of cases is higher, perhaps much higher than the number of cases we have so far confirmed with tests. And I've got to be clear, we've all got to be clear, this is the worst public health crisis for a generation. Some people compare it to seasonal flu. Alas, that is not right. Owing to the lack of immunity, this disease is more dangerous, and it's going to spread further. And I must level with you, level with the British public, many more families are going to lose loved ones before their time. And the Chief Scientific Advisor will set out the best information we have on that in a moment. But as we've said over the last few weeks, we have a clear plan that we are now working through.
Wow. All I can say is we've gone from it's only the weak ones that are going to die to we're going to lose loved ones. So what do you think about that, Martin?
Well, last week he was saying we may have to take this on the chin, and he's famous basically for winging it. So he's now putting on his serious voice, and maybe it isn't about Brexit after all. It's about we're all going to die of coronavirus. But 2 minutes ago, it was all going to blow over and there's nothing to worry about. It doesn't suggest that he's really up to the job, frankly, from my point of view.
And I think something else which is a bit disturbing is the postponement of local elections. On the 7th of May, we should be going to the polls. We should be voting for a police commissioner, an elected mayor and councillors. That isn't going to happen, is it?
Yes, and of course, if the government gets into a sticky mess with all of this, you know, the economy and the coronavirus, the May poll would start to take the shine off their so-called victory in December. But, of course, in a way, if we're going to take this seriously, maybe, you know, if we're going to go and knock on doors around here, for example, if people are basically trying to, you know, increase social distance, an election is not going to do that, is it? And, of course, that could lead to a situation where the US presidential election is cancelled. Think about that.
Well, I think we'd all like to think about that. But the trouble is, with the American election, we don't know if the result will be any different. But we do hope that something might be different here, but it's not going to happen for a year.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think this is a judgment call, isn't it? If we're going to take this thing seriously and we're going to cancel football matches, the elections may have to be cancelled too. But nevertheless, I'm not happy with the way I think we've got into this situation in the first place. In December last year, a majority, as always in the United Kingdom, voted against the Conservatives. And in any other country in Europe, like, for example, Denmark, Ireland, Scotland and Wales in their national elections, they wouldn't even be the government, never mind Boris telling us what to do about coronavirus. There's a lot of what I would call deference in this country. I went to Oxford University many years ago, and the people who run the country really think that the way we run it is the way to run it, and they're the people to do it. But, of course, the system is actually broke, and that's why we've got ourselves into this terrible mess over my lifetime.
I think one of the things that has touched most people is we talk about the political effects. It's a bit more than that, isn't it? Today, for example, football and other sporting events, including the London Marathon, have either been postponed, put off. That's got tremendous implications for the man in the street, really, hasn't it?
It has, and I think this crisis, obviously the coronavirus element of this is a novel and a bitter twist, but there was going to be a stock market crash. I've been saying it on this show since 2009 when we began the show. You can't just spend your way out of this by propping the banks up. But when we started this show over a decade ago, virtually everybody who came on agreed that something would have to be done about the banking system and the financial services sector. And all that's happened since then is we've carried on basically appeasing them, like Ethelred the Unready, like Neville Chamberlain, and now the chickens are coming home to roost.
And this week we've had the budget, obviously, but we've also had more government input on coronavirus. Some people would say the government are coming back really strongly, and well, they are pledging money, perhaps money we haven't got, to make things right. What do you think?
Well, I think we're going back to what in my youth would be called normal politics, where if you want to get elected, you've got to promise to do stuff for people rather than telling them to look after their own business. And that's a sea change. And, you know, as people listen to the show know, I'm a Labour activist, and the only thing, you know, the only comfort we can take out of the situation is that we've finally, people at the top have realised that there's absolutely no reason in a crisis why the government has to balance the books. That was basically idiotic, and it always was idiotic. That doesn't mean, as you say, that if you're going to spend the money, what you really need to do is say, we're not necessarily going to balance the books at this stage, but we've got to have a credible plan for balancing it in the medium term. And that means land taxes, wealth taxes, all that stuff, which is totally taboo. So what they've decided to do is, like the Tories in 1972, they've decided to go for growth. So they're just going to print money, spend money, but they're not going to raise money in the hopes that everything will be all right. But because of Brexit, there's a possibility of a run on the pound, which will, of course, crash the housing market. And then people really will realise what's going on.
I think there's a bit of a problem here because, as you say, information is actually turning out to be manipulation, possibly. Now, if you are a supporter of Boris, a supporter of the Conservatives, you would say, yeah, but, you know, they're acting so positively and they are showing their true abilities. It's a pity they didn't show them earlier, or is it just one of those things where you think we are actually being manipulated?
You know, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. And they're trying to, I mean, basically, the physical infrastructure and social infrastructure of the country has been devastated in my lifetime. Since the 1980s were absolutely ridiculously destructive. And if you look back, the big changes were the big bang in the City of London in 1987, the privatisation of stuff which should have remained in the public sector and still remains in the public sector in well-run countries in Scandinavia, and, of course, the creation of Al-Qaeda by our own intelligence services, which we're then told they went rogue. Well, that's a bit sad for them to go rogue since they were all trained by our own special forces.
Yes. Well, let's just listen to this bit from the Prime Minister's Question Time this week. Boris was talking about compensating people for doing the right thing. Is he really in touch with the person in the street, or is it just something that's being managed by...
Well, I mean, obviously his personality obviously appeals to some people, and I think that's the right decision. It's obviously the right decision. The people on zero-hours contracts and so on, if they're going to self-isolate, as they're being asked to do, then they've got to be supported to do that. They can't be just left with no money. And that means that the government has actually got to step up to the plate and do something. The market ain't going to do it.
I've got two clips here. One of these is in answer to a question at Prime Minister's Question Time about people on zero-hours contracts and so on. And the other is Jeremy Corbyn talking about sick pay.
A quarter of social care workers, who are overwhelmingly women, are on zero-hours contracts. It's essential care workers self-isolate if they experience symptoms of coronavirus, but many may feel they have no choice but to continue working. Will the Prime Minister finally bring in emergency legislation to guarantee sick pay for zero-hours workers to help contain the spread of the virus?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
Well, Mr. Speaker, I know the whole House will wish to join the Honourable Gentleman, Right Honourable Gentleman, in wishing my Honourable friend, the Minister for Mental Health, a speedy recovery. And I know, Mr. Speaker, that having talked to her, I know that she will make one. I know, Mr. Speaker, you issued a letter to everybody across the parliamentary estate. And as you say in your letter, Mr. Speaker, we will be guided by Public Health England in our response to this situation. And they are also providing guidance to honourable members and to their offices. And as the Right Honourable Gentleman knows, in just a few minutes we will be hearing from my Right Honourable Friend the Chancellor about what measures we are taking to protect everybody. As he knows, we've already brought forward statutory sick pay from day four to day one. But for those who are on all types of contracts, we will ensure that they get the protection that they need, and nobody who does the right thing by staying at home is penalised.
Jeremy Corbyn.
I hope that legislation comes rapidly, and it does guarantee that people don't have to make a choice between spreading the virus because they have to go to work or staying at home and self-isolate, as obviously they should do if they've got the symptoms.
Now, there's another point to this, because not everybody is on a 0 hours contract. Not everybody is a care worker. People who are self-employed, people who have staked their whole lives on what they're doing. Another question from Question Time.
As the numbers infected by the coronavirus grow, the level of public concern naturally grows with this. Last week, the Prime Minister gave me a firm reassurance that no one would be financially penalised for following health advice. And yet, still millions of self-employed workers have been left in deep uncertainty as to what financial help they will be given if they are forced to stop working. In this House, Mr. Speaker, we are in a privileged position. We will not be financially worse off. Millions of workers are not in that privileged position. They may be forced to rely on Social Security for an extended period because of this virus. So for the record, can the Prime Minister tell me what the statutory sick rate in Ireland is compared to his UK government?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it is not my duty to comment on the pay rates of other countries. What I can tell you, the honourable member, which he knows very well, is that we under this government have already advanced statutory sick pay from day four to day one. We will make sure that those on universal credit and other benefits get the help that they need from day one. And my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, if he can contain his impatience for just a little bit, we'll be telling him more about what we are doing to protect everybody in this society, to make sure that everybody is not penalised for doing the right thing.
In Blackburn.
Well, let me try and help the Prime Minister and perhaps inform him of the detail. In Ireland, in response to the coronavirus, the government has just raised their statutory sick rate to the equivalent of £266 per week. This covers those employed and those in self-employment. In Germany and Austria, it's £287. In Sweden, it's £230. In the Netherlands, £201. And in Spain, it's £121. Whereas in the UK, Prime Minister, it's a meagre £94.25 per week.
Kind of living that.
Prime Minister, up to 80% of people across the United Kingdom could face infection in the weeks and months ahead. Many of them will be forced to rely on statutory sick pay. If the Prime Minister is truly committed to levelling up, a good place to start must be statutory sick pay. Will he take the opportunity to stand up today and commit to raising the UK payment to the average EU level?
Mr. Speaker, as I think most members of the House understand, the UK is distinct from many other countries around the world and certainly in the EU. We have a universal free health system, free at the point of delivery. We have an extensive benefit system, free for people across this country. And indeed, our health system is very well managed, very well prepared for this epidemic. And I congratulate everybody in the NHS responsible for making the preparations that they have.
Now, Martin, does that make you think enough is being done?
No, obviously enough isn't being done, and the points were well made by that SNP guy. Listening to all of that, several things came to my mind. We talked about social care. A few years ago now, it must be nearly a decade ago now, the social carers in Bristol used to be employed directly by the council. They had a job for life, and they weren't particularly qualified, but they were obviously very skilled, and there was a huge esprit de corps about being a care worker in Bristol. And because of, I think it was the Lib Dem administration at the time, they decided they were going to basically get rid of that and put it out of, because it was cheaper to bring in private companies. But of course, the workers in the private companies who replaced the traditional workers were paid a lot less than the previous people had been paid. They were on something like nearly £10 an hour. And Charlotte Leslie, who was a newly elected Tory MP at that time, stood on a platform in Southmead at a protest organised by the local trade unions to protest against what's been done there. And of course, the other aspect of social care is that it's now very much done by people from in the EU and other places. And if they're not going to let those people come in to do those jobs, and Priti Patel is saying that Brits can do those jobs, but Brits will have to take the pay that the other lot were getting, and the Brits don't want to work for that kind of pay, which is why they're doing it. So that's the thing about social care, which is one of the biggest holes in the budget. Yeah, nobody really knows what to do with it. People will remember the so-called dementia tax and so on with Theresa May. And the wider question about what you do to support people, well, as the Greens have been saying for years, if you've got a universal basic income, people just go home and live on their universal basic income if they're sick. That's what it's for. So you don't have to get any special measures in place. They just go home and live on their basic income until the storm blows over. And of course, because people know that, it means that they can then make rational plans. And of course, he's right that we have got an NHS, but of course, you know, they've got the health services in Germany and France are not quite as good as the NHS because they're more expensive, but they are basically as good. I mean, the thing about the NHS is it's cheap as chips. That's what makes it such a fantastic system. Not that it's a brilliant system, it's just the best, cheapest way to do it. And of course, that's been undermined by the marketisation since the 1980s, where they're treated as a business, which is just a silly way to think of it.
Yeah. And there's another thing that comes from this. And, you know, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Do you think that some people will be taking advantage? Because quite honestly, if I was on the wage that some people were on, if I felt as undervalued as some people were, I would be sorely tempted to put myself into self-isolation.
All right, well, a bit of personal confession here. I work in schools as a support worker, and I still get a top-up every month from Universal Credit because my rent's so high, because I can't afford, there's no cheap way to live in Bristol. And of course, what's actually happening with that money is it goes directly to my landlords who are buying the house. So it's a subsidy to them, basically. And of course, people don't realise that they're being subsidised all the time. You know, people who buy houses in the housing market because they've got on the ladder, they get free money. And yeah. These are the kind of people who go on about scroungers. But anyway, the point is that if they close the schools, and we've been talking about this all day in school because it looks like it's coming, it's happening in Ireland, it's happening in France, then I will go home and I'll be in straitened circumstances, but Universal Credit, I presume, will pick up the slack because I'm already on it. I just have to send them not a text message, get online and say I've been sent home from school. There's no point in me looking for another job. This is my job. I'm just waiting for them to tell me to go back. And at that point, I just take the money. And of course, it's not a lot. It's £93 a week, but it's something.
And I think we heard the voice there in one of those clips, that canny Scottish woman saying, yeah, you cannot leave on that.
Well, you can't really.
No.
You can't.
No. I mean, in some ways, it seems like the government is being generous. In some ways, it seems like people may be taking advantage. I mean, I've heard of people that are planning big decorating projects, catching up on their box sets, redesigning their gardens.
Well, that's what happened in the 80s when people made redundant. They were given big redundancy packages. And, of course, that just gets frittered away. And then you're stuck with whatever you're stuck with. And a lot of the people who don't want to work, the tabloid press goes on about, do you know what? I've got news for them. The employers don't want to employ them either. In Cuba, they've been made to take them on. But we don't want them. They're lazy, they're work shy, they're incompetent. Yes, but it's a full employment society here. You've got to have your quota of losers. But we've got a free market economy here. Why should private sector employers take people on who haven't got the attitude? They don't want them.
Yeah, and that's always going to happen, isn't it?
Of course.
Now, going back to the coronavirus and the publicity, hand on heart, Martin, do you think that the amount of alarm that is being caused is okay? Because I've been watching the television, and while they've been talking about coronavirus, I've heard it called killer disease. We've heard it called that. And I've also seen shots of people in nursing homes laying in beds. And that is the backdrop to talking about coronavirus. Actually, there are not many people in care homes that have got it.
Not yet. Hopefully.
Of course, the implication is most care homes, the people have got it. And I heard somebody today being interviewed on the radio. And the person who was doing the interview said to her, allowing visitors into your care home, you know, is that irresponsible? And they were talking about, you know, visiting old people. And she said, oh, no, it definitely all ought to be stopped.
Well, I think there's two things there, isn't there, really? Is the level of paranoia too great? I think you don't have to be... If we all take the... You know, what's the old saying? A stitch in time saves nine. What the Chinese Communist Party did when they realised that this was all running out of control, at first they attempted to keep it quiet, and then they decided, right, we're going to have to chuck everything but the kitchen sink at this. And the reason for doing that is because you don't then have to deal with the follow-on consequences. And you can see quite clearly that as we said earlier at the beginning of the show, the coronavirus, in fact, I mean, most financial analysts are very well aware it isn't the coronavirus that's crashing the economy. It was going to crash anyway because all of this stuff was coming to a head. The trade war with China, which could be related to this. You see, that's what the Chinese have got their own internet and they've got their own public opinion. And they're saying, well, you're accusing us of doing all of this, but we're actually thinking it's you. You know, and don't forget, those who've listened to the show over 10 years will know we've got there's a whole track record of Western intelligence services and deep state doing some pretty shockingly appalling stuff. And therefore, they're not squeaky clean people who wouldn't do stuff like that. I'm not saying they've done it. I'm just saying it's quite possible that the Chinese, through their own stupidity, have leaked their own biological warfare agent. But they wouldn't have done it deliberately, even if that's the case. But in any case, I think that speculation, as I said earlier, Roma, it's more important that we take the right steps now. And it's a real challenge for the solidarity of human society, isn't it?
It is. And certainly in Italy, for example, all shops apart from supermarkets and pharmacies are closed. Now, that's got a tremendous economic impact.
Oh, it's going to crash the Italian banking system pretty rapidly. By the time we come back next week, the banking system could be no more. That's how bad it is.
Yeah. The stock market has dropped, hasn't it, so much. I mean, it's...
Yeah, well, once it starts dropping, it doesn't drop a bit and then settle down. Because if it's been overbought for years because they've been pumping all of this funny money into it, which you're not supposed to do, they threw the textbook out of the window, they were cruising for a fall. And, of course, Trump's trying to get re-elected on the back of all of this, you know, pumping it all up. But you're not supposed to do that. And in actual fact, there's a very wide consensus between right-wing and left-wing economists that that's not what you should do. But they've done it anyway because it was the easy option and it made loads of people loads of money. As long as they get out in time, they'll have walked away with everybody else's assets. You know, it's basically theft on a massive scale.
Yeah. Let's just listen to Trump, because this is the man who has got his finger on the button, essentially, in more ways than one. This is what he had to say yesterday.
Today, the World Health Organization officially announced that this is a global pandemic. We have been in frequent contact with our allies, and we are marshaling the full power of the federal government and the private sector to protect the American people. This is the most aggressive and comprehensive effort to confront a foreign virus in modern history. I am confident that by counting and continuing to take these tough measures, we will significantly reduce the threat to our citizens, and we will ultimately and expeditiously defeat this virus. After consulting with our top government health professionals, I have decided to take several strong but necessary actions to protect the health and well-being of all Americans. To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days. The new rules will go into effect Friday at midnight. These restrictions will be adjusted subject to conditions on the ground. There will be exemptions for Americans who have undergone appropriate screenings, and these prohibitions will not only apply to the tremendous amount of trade and cargo, but various other things as we get approval. Anything coming from Europe to the United States is what we are discussing. These restrictions will also not apply to the United Kingdom. At the same time, we are monitoring the situation in China and the South Korea, and as their situation improves, we will reevaluate the restrictions and warnings that are currently in place for a possible early opening.
So, is he just stirring the pot? What do you think, Martin?
Well,
and
I mean,
why are we exempt in the
well,
UK?
Well, I think it's just pure politics. Mm. I mean, the interesting thing he said, that cargo was going to be banned from Europe. He had to backtrack from that. So he's supposed to be the guy in charge. He's got people to advise him. No, we're not stopping all trade with Europe. Yeah, and he had to say, "Oh no, I didn't mean that." And you think, can you read a teleprompt? Is that what was on the teleprompt? Yeah, probably it was what was on the teleprompt, but it shows that the people who advise him don't know what they're talking about, because of course they immediately had to row back. Now, if you're going to have a ban on travel between Europe and the US, you've got to have a full-on ban. They didn't ban China from doing it, you know. Why, and they didn't ban. They've cancelled the war games in South Korea, but they haven't cancelled the war game in Eastern Europe, which is about to start next week, where 30,000 American troops are going to arrive with no coronavirus screening and wander around in countries which have got loads of coronavirus. Now, if you're serious about cutting off, I mean, I don't know whether it's the right tack, but if you're going to do it, then do it. But this is just pointless. Yeah, it doesn't even do anything, and the exemption of Britain is a way of trying to prise Britain away from the European Union and all the rest of it, which is obviously what's uppermost in his mind and being re-elected, rather than, you know, the underlying stuff. But I mean, Putin years ago said, "Are you friendly with Trump?" And he said, "No, I'm not particularly friendly with him or unfriendly with him." We've realised years ago that it doesn't matter who's the president of the US, because they don't decide anything. It's people behind them that decide things, and those are the ones we're really talking to.
That is so profound. Yeah, so what we've basically got here is Trump is a right-winger. We've got a right-wing government in this country. They have taken the action that they think to be right. We can see holes in this. But what do you think the long-term consequence of this whole problem is going to be politically?
Well, it's not just politically. The main problem is that the economy is going to collapse, which has been, we've had, this is what really infuriates me about all the rowing we've had about Brexit in this country. It's not that there isn't a case to be made for or against it. It's just largely irrelevant to what's the real problem, which is the banking system went down the drain in 2008 and was rescued by the taxpayer. And at that point, serious reform had to be undertaken. And that's what happened in the 30s, because Roosevelt came to power in the US, took the situation by the scruff of the neck and sorted it out, not entirely successfully, but with a lot more vigour than the people that have done it this time. And so we've got used to the idea that capitalism just bumbles along, but capitalism is supposed to run on zero interest rates and money printing. That's not capitalism. It's just a fantasy, and the fantasy is coming to an end. And when it does come to an end, we're not prepared in any way, shape or form as a society or the political leadership for the consequences, apart from a few lonely voices.
So what will happen? Because we've established that the banks will, they'll go under. What then?
Well, what will happen? The Boeing this week started calling in as much money as they could from their bankers, because they think that the banks are going to go down, and they're trying to ensure that they will survive, because they're in a desperate situation. So that the crash is coming from both ends. You've got the top end, the sort of financial services, the derivatives market, the shadow banking system, which is even more out of control than it was in 2008. And you've also got a bottom end thing, that China is coming to a halt. They're the world's factory. Yeah. This is the stupid idea of having sanctions on Russia and China. If you were to successfully crash the Russian or the Chinese economy, then the rest of the world economy would follow them into the black hole inevitably, which is why it's such a stupid way to proceed. We've actually reached the point where we are absolutely interdependent as a species, but we're still playing 19th century games of one-upmanship with 21st century weapons.
In which position would you be more frightened, Martin? Would it be if you were well off, maybe a businessman who could see that things are not going good, or if you were a much poorer person who lived pretty much from hand to mouth? Which would be the most frightening situation?
Clearly the poorer. I mean, the people who've got loads of money have got their money to lose, but people all over the world, a crash of that consequence. I mean, the stuff I've read, you would have millions of people would die as a result of that. So it's pretty dramatic. But of course, in places like Iraq, which they recently voted to kick all foreign forces out, and people die every day, they've got a bit of a different attitude from, you know, the people in countries like Britain who vote to go to war with places like Iraq, but they've never been there.
Yeah. And when it comes to things like sport, Will it recover? Will we ever see the return of multi-millionaire footballers?
Well, I mean, I don't know is the simple answer to that. Mm. It may be that the coronavirus itself will be contained. We hope it might, although it looks like it might go on for quite a while and come, but, you know, it's not easily going to be dealt with. Mm. But the consequences of the collapse of the banks is pretty dramatic. And what happened in the 30s when that happened was there was a revolution inside America. And, you know, because America was a more open society in many ways than it's become. And, you know, people with more radical ideas were able to get a grip. And, of course, it's important for the rest of the world that that happens because America is so... It was very powerful even then. The joke used to be America sneezes and the world catches cold. It's even more so now. Yeah?
Yeah.
And therefore, in a sense, the relationship between Britain and the US is so important. It's not a special relationship in the way that general media talk about it, but there is a two-way cultural influence between us. And we are able to influence American culture in a way that nobody else is able to do, if you think about the Beatles and all of that. And that was based on the fact that the US military were based here during the war, and lots of relationships were formed. The sort of music scene here was really kicked into a totally different space by having all these black servicemen working and women coming over and showing us how to do it.
And I guess also it's boosted by the shared language, because we were talking earlier, much earlier, about people who were working in the care sector, for example, often have come from Eastern Europe in the past. They didn't just chance on the UK as a good place to be. Most people in Eastern Europe do learn English, don't they, at school?
They do. Well, I used to work in Eastern Europe and I used to teach English to young people to earn some money. And the enthusiasm to learn English was overwhelming because all the stuff they're interested in, sport, fashion, politics, if they're interested in politics, it's all done in English.
Yeah.
And the language of the internet is English. And it's a huge advantage to Britain. And therefore not to be sneezed at, if you like.
Yeah.
But it also leads to a kind of laziness about learning foreign languages, and I admit to that myself. I mean, I lived in Poland for several years, 5 years, and I tried to learn it. I thought it's just too hard, can't be bothered, because everybody under 25 speaks English anyway.
Yeah. Tourism is going to be another facet, isn't it, of failure, or will we do
better? Well, the problem with all of these things is... If it's over quickly, then businesses can recover. But if there's a permanent change in people's behaviour, I mean, that's what happened after the Black Death. The Black Death was pretty devastated. It ended feudalism, basically, because once, the people bid up their wages. At once, I've read historical studies that show after the Black Death and just before the Peasants' Revolt, the peasants were in a better state than they'd ever been. They were becoming confident as a social class rather than downtrodden. They were sick of being treated like they'd been treated previously, and that's what led to the Peasants' Revolt. It wasn't a kind of revolt of the completely downtrodden, because the Black Death had completely changed the balance of power in the society, but that wasn't represented in the way things were being done. And ultimately that led to capitalism, which led us to this, where we are now, which is where capitalism has basically played its, that's my view, it's played its role. And that doesn't mean it's going to get rid of completely. The market isn't going to disappear anytime soon, but it's not going to function like it did before.
And in a lesser way than the Black Death syndrome that you just mentioned, after the First World War, lots of people, when they came back, and also after the Second World War, people came back and they said, you're not treating me like that anymore.
Well, that's right. I mean, the biggest social changes in this country clearly happened after the First and Second World Wars. And I'm afraid it's a sad fact of history that democracy and the empowerment of the common people is often associated with war. The Athenian democracy was forged in war with the Persian autocracy and then with the Spartans, and that's where it came from. Because the deal becomes, if I'm going to die for the country, well, you're going to listen to what I've got to say, and that was very much the case at the end of both First and Second World Wars, and most of the things that we value came out of that era. And of course, the bits we talked earlier about the 40s, people think about the 60s as the big social decade of change, but the real decade of change is the 40s. People's attitude to life changed quite dramatically. You know, you can only marry who your parents like, you've got to go to bed by 10 o'clock. All of that went out the window.
Yeah. And tourism is going to be a massive thing, though, because we've already seen one airline go under in last week. It's not going to be the only one. I was talking to somebody today who has got connections to tourism, and he said, actually, bookings are quite slow.
Understatement. English understatement.
Well, yeah, it's English understatement, but he wasn't talking about going on holiday next month. He was talking about going on holiday next year.
Yeah.
And people's attitudes will change, and instead of thinking we want three holidays abroad each year, I think also this is being pushed a bit by the Greens.
Well, I mean, you know, so there are some on the more wacky fringe of the Green movement who actually regard it as a good thing that people are killed so that the birds and the plants can. I mean, I saw a thing today, it's a joke in the back of somebody's car, don't know whether they're a Green or not, it's just pretend to be an NH leaf about coronavirus, said, let's get rid of the people as soon as possible so the planet can recover. But I think you know, the Greens come on this show all the time, and I'm sure they would, you know, I'm not accusing them of anything like that. I think the problem is there's a whole debate that goes on in economics about, you know, whether we need economic growth at all. And I used to work for the New Economics Foundation. We used to have lots of discussions about this. I think ultimately you've got to economic growth. You've got to consider economic growth as economic change. You always want to be improving the way you do stuff. Yeah, you don't want to be satisfied with the way you're doing stuff. But that doesn't mean you have to change the overall resource intensivity of what you're doing. Yeah. In other words, you can carry on improving. You know, if we can really, really make our kit efficient, then we can do the same amount with much less resources. And therefore, that's the way out of the trap.
That's true. We've got very greedy in recent times. Some of the big employers, some of the big organisations, and I'm thinking, for example, of Marks and Spencers, their complaint has been, we haven't made as many millions as we thought we would. That isn't the same as we're going under or we're staying stable. It just means we're not getting as rich as we rather hoped.
Well, in economics textbooks, people who just try and get by rather than maximise their profits are called satisficers. So you satisfice. You don't satisfy yourself by going for more and more and more. You satisfice. You just settle for a niche. And interestingly enough, in the 20s, the cooperative shops, because they were exempt from certain taxes, because they were friendly societies, were out-competing the private sector supermarkets. And it was only because the private sector supermarkets lobbied the Tory governments of the era that the co-op was stopped in its tracks. And the thing about the co-op shops is they could keep a shop open in a deprived community as long as it was breaking even. They didn't have to make a profit. And they could even cross-subsidise things that weren't making a profit in some communities as long as they were making a profit somewhere else.
Now, that's got the bad name of undercutting, but in fact...
Well, it's called competition.
Competition.
If you're going to have competition.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was a real problem for the private sector, is these people are out-competing us. And the, you know, a cooperative bank has obviously gone down the drain in recent years. But the cooperative shops continue to be a very solid organisation. I mean, they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And, they're an achievement of previous generations.
And I think they're a little bit of an example to all of us. I mean, I walk into my local co-op and I don't think there's that much different and was on the shelves 30 years ago. You can still buy tapioca, you can still buy sago, you can buy all the things you need every day, but they haven't done anything flashy. And maybe, do you think we've gone for too much flashy and too much profit?
Well,
I
think it depends who your customers are, doesn't it? Let's face it. I mean, Waitrose is a workaround, you know, it's John Lewis, it's a workaround co-op, but the kind of people who shop in there tend to be a bit more upmarket because that's the niche they're going for.
Yeah.
I mean, years ago, I used to live in Lubartov in Poland, which is a small town in Poland. And when the factories closed there, quite a lot of people set up lots of little small shops as a way to make a living. So they must have had hundreds of small shops in quite a small town. But when the cooperative shops, SPOEM as they used to call them, which had been run by the government, they were set up before the war as cooperatives. Then the government had taken them over during the communist era. And they were sad. You'd walk in there. And I remember my girlfriend walking in there and saying she wanted to buy some milk. And the woman there said, but I'll have to go in the freezer to get that milk. And I don't want to go in the freezer. And she thought that was the mentality. But of course, what then happened is they brought people in from the Cooperative Wholesale Society here in Britain to do the training. And then once they got them up and running, they outcompeted all the small shops because they can buy in bulk and all the rest of it. And that was a big problem for Lubato, because people had adapted in one way to the loss of their factory livelihood. They'd turned themselves into small business people. And then capitalism really got going, including reorganised cooperative shops, and they were being edged out. And of course, the fundamental problem is what are people going to do for a living? And of course, what happened in Poland is that they've got a very young, they're quite weird in East European terms, because it's a Catholic country, got a very young population, and they all had to leave because there wasn't the work there. And that's why they're here and elsewhere in Western Europe.
Yes, it's a very complex thing. And when it comes to what opportunity is going to be offered to us, because in every negative there's a positive, what are the opportunities that are going to come out of the aftermath of the coronavirus? Are we going to see loads of small, agile businesses getting back on their feet and flourishing, and the big guys going under? Are we going to see everybody with their lives much diminished? What do you think, Martin?
Well, I think, to be absolutely honest, at my age, I'm 60 years old, I have to be absolutely truthful to people that it's likely to be pretty grim. And I saw what happened in Eastern Europe with the collapse of communism. Think about that. Yeah, it's going to be a big change for people, far more rapid than they can imagine. And I've got the imagination and the experience to see it in that way. There are ways to get out of it, and there are positive steps we can take. As I said earlier, this is a big test of the solidarity of the human community. What if it was the case that we got a decent person elected in the US and they got together with the Chinese and the Russians, and the Chinese have been proposing what is effectively a Marshall Plan for the developing world? Why don't we upgrade them? Because that's in everybody's interest, isn't it? We'll turn them into customers.
Yes. The expanding gap in society is one of the things that may well come about, because earlier we heard about compensating people who were doing the right thing. We're talking about people that rely on their wages every month, every week. And then we're thinking of the way that business is going to apparently be compensated. And the way that it's going to be is, instead of giving big business the tax break that they expected in the budget, in fact, they're now not going to have that, and that money, and that's several billion, well, quite a few billion pounds, is going to be towards soothing society. Is it going to soothe society?
Well, we're moving in the right direction at last, but it's not enough. As I said earlier, the obvious, if we'd already got a basic income system in position, we would be very well placed to weather the storm, so we wouldn't be making it up on the hoof. I mean, and the other thing that really annoys me about the banking crisis, the last time it happened, when Brown was the Prime Minister, they had to call in all the top bods and come up with a plan to bail the banks out. And, you know, they had to stay there for 48 hours and bring in curry and stuff while they came up with a plan. Now, that is not good enough. That was always going to happen. Yeah. And Gordon Brown used to be, he got a PhD in economics. He ought to have known that, but he was blindsided by it. Because what happens is people just get used to their comfort zones, you know, whether they're running a business or a country or whatever it is, and they forget that, you know, you can go out, you know, once you're outside your comfort zone, you've got to think, what are the the threats and the weaknesses in what you're dealing with, you know? And there should have been a plan to go. I mean, there are certain people in the Bank of England, Haldane's quite sensible, who think like this. And Danny Blanchflower used to be on the board, but isn't anymore. He's quite sensible. But there's an awful lot of groupthink. I mean, they learn in most of the mainstream economics schools what is basically pseudoscience. It's all based upon mathematics. You know, the mathematics all adds up. But it's not about mathematics. It's like physics. You don't write the maths first. You look at the phenomenon and then write your equations. But they go the other way about it. They say, well, we've got this very, very complex thing. Some of these derivatives are just so complex that you've got to have a degree in PhD in maths or something like that to understand what they're doing. But, of course, you don't have to understand what they're doing if it's wrong.
And this economic misinformation that is being fed, is this coming from people who've been through the system, as in, well, that's what I learned, it's got to be right? Is this something that is being put upon the universities?
Yes, I mean, basically what's happened, when I was learning economics in the 1970s, we were basically taught that all this free market stuff was a load of old, it was old hat, basically. Mm. We don't believe in that anymore. We've moved on. And what happened, in my 20s, is stuff that my tutors, like Robert Mabro, had told me, well, this is old hat, we don't do that anymore. It all came back. And, we knew that this was not the way to run it 50 years ago. The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money by Keynes was published in 1936. But you will find that many Tory cabinet ministers, and we've had Jacob Rees-Mogg on this show some years ago debating with me about economics, they basically believe the old, they're basically, from my point of view, old believers in the old fairy tales. And that's because it also, that what happens with this is you get vested interests. Yeah. The banks were bailed out, and that's why they're in favour of doing it the way they do it. And I'll quickly finish. When the crash happened in 2008, there was this guy, I've forgotten his name, the film made about it, who broke away from the rest of Wall Street and he bet that the market was going to crash. And everybody thought he was bonkers. But he set up his own company, and when the market crashed, he made a fortune. So he then went to dinner with his old boss from the mainstream banking system. He said, oh, you've become very famous over the years. I mean, you were the guy who called it right, and how much are you worth now? And he said, I'm worth twice that for getting it wrong. So who's the mug?
Yes. Now, from a Tory point of view, I would guess the supporters of Boris are saying what we want is small, agile businesses to thrive, some of the older dinosaur businesses to lose, people to re-evaluate their lives, maybe a bit less travel, a bit less frivolous pleasure, a bit less consumerism, and back to basics. That is what I guess most people would take as a positive from what has been. Well, it's not just a health crisis, it's going to be probably a bit of a social crisis. Already people are opting out of big gatherings, social events, all that kind of thing. If you had a magic wand, what would you say would be the best outcome from this solution?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to say is that, we're all in favour of agile businesses, but you've also got to have your basics right. You've got to have the healthcare system, the education system, in terms of GNP, that's nearly half your economy. Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's not done in the market if you're doing it right. And ultimately, the market, as we go forward, ultimately, if we can get... to where we need to go, most things will be free and we won't be provided through the market. But some things will be. We're not going to get rid of markets. People have got new ideas for new stuff. We want to hear what they want to do. But most people will still have to be reliant on, things which are just properly organised for them. And, things like buses, for example, could easily be free. Why we're arguing about how to pay for them all the rest. You just make them free and people will get on them quite easily because you just get on and get off. You don't have to pay any money. You don't have to anybody collect the money. Yeah. And you've got to think outside the box. And, of course, the possibility emerges, as I said earlier, that a more aware leadership in the West will cooperate with the Russians and the Chinese to revolutionise the way we do business in the world. So everybody gets a look in, and we're not saying that we're going to, you've got to create agreements that allow competition, but all competition has to operate within rules, like football or rugby or cricket or anything. Because if there's no rules, it's not a game, it's a war. You can't just take your cricket bat and whack it in the other guy's face. And that's basically, unfortunately, where we still are. We're still at that stage. Where people think that they can base, if you can make more money, for example, by speculating in the stock market than building a better widget, then that's where the money's going to go. Yeah? And and that's what happens. All the resources are dragged in the wrong direction because you've just got the wrong orientation. Stock markets never used to be that important. You know, the stock market crashed in 1929 in the US, and it didn't get back to the level it had been in 1929 until 1953. And in the interim, US society was completely transformed. People were educated, roads were built, dams were built, a war was won, all without any big input from the stock market. We've got used to the idea that the stock market, we've got to have a stock market. Why? What's it for?
I think there are people that would consider the stock market important because they've got all their wealth invested in it. But
well, that's because you've got zero interest rates in the bank. And you only get zero interest rates if you lend your money to the government. So everybody's being herded towards the stock market, which is like sheep being herded towards the slaughterhouse. And what will happen is that the big boys will bail out and the little people will be left holding the bag. That's what always happens.
So will they be shoring up society?
Well, what will happen is that the wealthy, if they get out, and of course, if they can crash it according to their timetable, if you've got insider knowledge, and a lot of insider knowledge is involved in all of this, yeah?
Yeah.
Then you can move your shares around just at the right moment to make money and get out at the right time. So, for example, when Britain attacked Syria in April 2018, Theresa May's husband happens to be a hedge fund dealer, and he changed all of his investments the day before because of pillow talk from his wife, and he made a killing, literally.
I didn't know that, and I don't.
Oh yes, it's an allegation, but it's a pretty clear one allegation. Because how can you stop her talking to him about it? And of course, he then knows that that's going to happen, so he can then. What he did is he bought loads of shares in Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and things like that because they all shot up just after the assassination of Soleimani. All of the shares in the military industrial complex shot up. Now, if you were on inside track of knowing that you were going to assassinate Soleimani, which obviously Boris Johnson wasn't, talking about sovereignty, did the Americans bother to tell us about that? And of course, there's this young British girl's been killed yesterday in Iraq with the retaliation. So we might, just out of courtesy, the Americans might say, we're just going to assassinate the top Iranian general. But those who are in that loop all have shares. You can be sure the top generals, all of them, they've all got their shares in the stock market. They'll all have picked up and said to their brokers, right.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Big countries. The big people and the little people, and it just goes on and on and on, doesn't it?
Well, it's the history of human beings. We're pack animals, so we're very status conscious. So we don't live in splendid isolation, we live in groups. And we're very status conscious, which is why young children are so aware, and I work with young children, of the whole concept of fairness. Yeah?
Yeah.
They know that some kids are going to win and some kids are going to lose in any game or anything else you're doing. But they can smell unfairness straight away.
Human nature.
Well, yeah, because there's a book called The Spirit Level, which came out some years ago now, by Wilson and Pickett,
yeah.
Richard Wilson and Kate Pickett. So I think of it as Wilson Pickett, the great soul singer.
Here comes the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.